Blog Talk Radio.
This is a program for all America.
Indeed, welcome aboard. It is the Amy Beth Erkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. Hope you had a great weekend. It's August, and already, I'll tell you, the Oscar race is on. Yeah, I saw Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine over the weekend. A fantastic film. I think it ranks up there with his best. And Cate Blanchett, she's already on the shortlist for Best Actress Oscar. I know it's early. We'll talk more about that a bit later. Hey, the number is up and running, 347-857-4505. Gets you into the free-flow pop culture convo, as time permits. We'll also check out the hot justice stories, and there are lots of them, with our pal Patrick Moore from the All Things Crime blog. That's coming up in a bit. First, though, you know, you're never too old to rock and roll. I've got two guys coming your way, Greg Piper and Neil Warner, who formed this band, The Tuners. They've been rocking and rolling for decades out in L.A. They have a phenomenal website, Rock and Roll Rehab, which offers their music, live and otherwise, and great animation, and also kind of a free-form talk about rock and roll for newbies and old rockers alike, some fascinating things. You can waste a lot of time on that blog and enjoy yourself and come away happier for the trip, as they say. So we're going to talk with them. First, I want to play a selection of one of their songs, if we can find it. Are we ready, kids? The TCS booth, Trudy, Aurora, ML, hanging out with us today. Let's start with this one. There are a couple of really good ones. This one is called Drawings from My Mind. It's The Tuners opening up the Monday edition of the Amy Beth Erkowitz Show. Give a listen. I cap, right? That's a beauty from the Tuners, Drawings from My Mind, opening up the Monday show here on the Amy Beth Arkwee Show. You know, I worked at a radio station years ago, and they moved me from evenings to morning drive. It was a promotion, I guess. But we had a sign in the studio that said, if it's too loud, you're too old. And when I did morning drive, I said, it can never be too loud to keep you up. So I'm very happy that Neil Warner and Greg Piper from the Tuners joins us. They are live out in L.A., so it's earlier for rock and rollers. It's a little like 9 o'clock in the morning, so I'm glad you guys got up early for us. Thank you so much for joining us. Hi, Neil. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Amy. Hello. Fine.
Hi there. Glad to have you guys here. Tell me, you guys have been doing this for a long time, rocking and rolling for decades. I always talk with people. I work as a creativity coach and an author myself, and when I work with people as a coach and counselor and teacher, a lot of people are not happy with what they're doing, and you know, they get old before their time. And I always say you've got to find the passion or reignite your passion. And you guys obviously have been following your dream for years. Tell me a little bit about where you got that, when you heard the clarion call that music was your thing. Neil, you want to open up for us?
Well, like a lot of people of our generation, it was the Beatles. Yep. And I saw the Beatles arrive at was it JFK? Yeah, I guess it was JFK. Back in 64, and there were all these teenage girls screaming. You know, they were hanging onto a chain-link fence just screaming their heads off, and I was frightened, to tell you the truth. I didn't know what was going on. This was the news. And I called my parents in the room. I said, what the hell's going on here? And my mom said, oh, it's the Beatles. And I said, what are the Beatles? She goes, they're a band. And I said, why are these girls screaming? She goes, because they like them. And I thought, okay, that's what I want to do. It's the same old story. You say, why did you get into music? Well, it's
girls.
It's girls, yeah.
That's the short answer, okay.
That's the short answer. How about you, Greg?
But obviously it was more than that, because you dedicated your life to it. So obviously you found something else in the music itself.
I dedicated my life to girls. that's what keeps you going, because if you were doing it for money, then you're insane. Because
Hey Amy, when I first the Beatles got me going too. Before that, I didn't have much of a life. I'd spend my every other evening watching the washing machine spin around, you know, in the basement. And I lived in New York way back then. And my parents just happened to say, check out this show. It's the Ed Sullivan Show. And there they were, the Beatles. And, you know, seeing all those screaming girls and didn't scare me, Neil. It kind of got me excited. And, you know, just the electricity, something different, something. It resonated inside of me that, you know, people like me just started playing air guitar and singing Beatles songs. And
You saw the girls screaming for the band on stage on the Ed Sullivan Show. I saw them screaming at an airport, and I had no idea why they were screaming.
So you thought it was like a plane crash or something tragic.
Yeah. It was. I thought it was something horrible happened.
You think that would have been like a trauma that you would have avoided it then, but you still went headfirst into the.
I realized my mother described them like Elvis, you know, because we were used to girls screaming for Elvis, and the Bobby Sox are screaming for Frank Sinatra. So it's a tradition. What was great about the Beatles is that you didn't have to be an Elvis or a Frank Sinatra. They were one of a kind. There were four Beatles, and you could conceivably be a Beatle. And as the years went on, you know, you had the British Invasion bands that were basically all Beatles. You know, they all kind of looked the same and did the same kind of music. So you thought, I could do that. And you didn't have to be the star.
Yeah.
You could be a drummer or bass player or a guy in the background, but still be a Rolling Stone, still be one of the Animals or the Yardbirds.
Yeah,
well, that's
Amy,
interesting, because that's part of the whole band. I was just going to say that's part of the whole band experience which you guys have created. Go ahead, Greg, I'm sorry.
That's totally what got me off, too. I mean, because before then it was just like your single singers, stars, with anybody backing them up, and here were four guys all treated kind of the same. They were like a gang, a cool gang, a group of guys playing music, and you know, it was exciting.
Yeah, and then your music kind of got a little more psychedelic. You got into that whole more later 60s, 70s kind of sound, because you still have a little bit of that going in your music now. Is that right? I know Neil, you're very into the whole psychedelic era. You did a lot of artwork, and I know you have a novel out which I happen to see on your blog, called The Hate, which is about the Summer of Love. So is that still an influence in your work?
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I'm really happy that you noticed that because, yeah, it's a big thing for me. I think what happens when you get into junior high school, whatever is big at the time really sticks with you because for the first time in your life, sex has entered into it. You know, you start thinking about girls around that time. So now anything that's important to you at that moment in time is very important. And I was in... I was about that age in the, you know, the Summer of Love and the psychedelic era. So I was, I mean, I was way too young to participate, but I was a, you know, total student of the whole thing and just followed it. And,
right.
And we lived in L.A. and would go up to San Francisco. So the whole thing was happening, you know, just a few hundred miles away and in our own backyard. L.A. had a big, you know, hippie psychedelic scene. So it was always really big.
So you had that, you had, because it's interesting because I love this whole era too and I'm too young to really remember it. So it's sort of like a faux nostalgia for this kind of time, and in some ways it's more powerful because you're kind of creating what it was in your head too. So it's the imagination, your childhood, your adolescent imagination playing games with you of what it should be, what it could be, with what, juxtaposed with what really was going on at the same time, and that kind of fixated in your mind.
Well, that's what I did with the book, with The Hate, which is my version of what it could have been like to have been a hippie back then. We were all basically hippies, but we were Southern California hippies, Hollywood hippies. So a lot of it, I transferred it to San Francisco. But, you know, the experience was very similar, and I studied the whole era, so a lot of what was going on I put in there. But that was my idea. There was a movie came out called Big Wednesday about surfers. John Milius directed it, and it was just about what it was like to be surfers in Southern California in the 60s. So this is my version of what it might have been like to be, you know, hippies in the late 60s.
You were using your imagination a little bit too, obviously, to put your feelings of what it would have been like had you been old enough.
It's a novel. It's not nonfiction.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but you just said you were too young to really experience it. You were using what you thought was going on and what you were kind of fantasizing about as a kid.
Well, I was
cool.
Too young to experience it in 1967. By 1972, I wasn't too young to experience it. But,
okay.
But that was after the fact. So we actually experienced a lot of it,
something.
But just
right.
Later time frame.
Right. So what are some of, so you mentioned the Beatles. Who else influenced you in terms of your music? Greg, who are your big musical influences beyond the Beatles?
When the Beatles disappeared, which broke a lot of our hearts, Led Zeppelin took over for me. I remember sitting in the back seat of a car and hearing this track, an early Zeppelin track, and it was the next thing for me. Zeppelin and our Doors, I don't know, The Who, love The Who. Those are my major influences. I even like the Monkees, some of their stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they have some cool stuff. How about you, Neil? Who else besides the
All the 60s bands that we liked had really exceptional careers. I mean, they went into the 80s, a lot of these bands. So they were still around, but I got heavily into prog rock. That seemed to be the natural evolution from psychedelic into prog. At that point, the music got very difficult to play. There were no longer live venues locally to play it at, so it was really, and you can't dance to it. So we really kind of re-emerged in the new wave era, got the band back together, because we had been in bands. I had been in bands since the 60s, since grammar school for me. And Greg and his brother, who have a great show called Just Imagine at the Hayworth Theater. It's a John Lennon. They've been doing Beatle music forever. They have always been doing this, but, you know, cover tunes and Beatle songs. And in the late 70s, we got the band back together to do, you know, originals, and we were originally called Womanizer.
I saw that.
Yeah. You got to keep in mind, New
Wave
had
a completely incorrect
humor.
Label, but that's okay.
Yeah, we it was supposed to be ironic. There were bands like the Marina Swingers and the Lounge Lizards, so we were supposed to be in that vein. When heavy metal started taking over from New Wave, which turned out to be a flash in the pan, suddenly our name wasn't funny anymore. And we started being seen as part of the heavy metal scene, which we were not a part of. And that's when we changed the name to the Tuners.
And you do some, speaking of tuners, you have these very cool cartoon animation that goes with a lot of your songs, which is...
That's what we're called.
Check out their website. Yeah, rockandrollrehab.com. You got some very cool stuff there. Talk a little bit about... Now, this is your artistic background. I guess, Neil, are you the driving force with the animation?
Yeah, originally in the band, there were a couple animators. Corey Harris was another artist, a talented cartoonist, and he was in Womanizer, and we put the band together. This is early days of MTV, saying we're going to illustrate our own music and we're going to make animated music videos. And we started by putting out a magazine called Paper Cuts, the Illustrated Lyrics magazine, which had our song lyrics in comic book form. And then we had a flexi disc sound sheet, which is one of those, you know, thin plastic records that came inserted in magazines,
yes.
Which, you know, the kids today will know what I'm talking about. They're going to say, what's a magazine? Then they're going to say, what's a record? So,
I don't know. Vinyl's making a comeback now, though. Did you know that?
Well, they got
that,
records out.
The vinyl is,
yeah.
Vinyl is.
So we were always into illustrating our, you know, our material. And our fans started referring to us as, you know, the tuners, meaning the cartooners, the cartoonists.
Yeah.
So
right,
we just
right.
sort of naturally decided to drop Womanizer because everybody's thinking we're a heavy metal band. And we'll just call ourselves the Tuners.
You sound much more friendly as the Tuners. And the animation is
yes.
very cool. It's very interesting. It's a very interesting companion site kind of to all your activities that are going on. And you have some interesting commentary in your blog. I found out about your novel. I also found out you had a blog about the top, I don't know how many, there were 50 or 100 psychedelic bands you should listen to before you die. I mean, just very interesting stuff. So if people are interested in an eclectic array of info about music and the music biz and behind the scenes, they can find it there as well. Talk about your career and just the idea of, as you said, if you're going in for it for money, forget it. You got to go in for it for the passion. What advice do you give people who are starting out now? I mean, the music business, of course, has changed over the years that you've been in it. In some ways, it's easier if you get easier access to people in terms of the internet and all of that. But in some ways, it's also more difficult because people can just, you know, co-opt your
material. I'm the last one to give advice to how to succeed.
Yeah, you don't want advice from us, Andy.
No, well, Greg is better. Greg has actually made a living being a musician, so he could tell you.
Well, the whole idea was to do your own music. Listen, I've quit probably 1,000 jobs. I could have been president of by now if I stuck with them, but I would have hated myself. I hated the work, the day job, the, you know, what you had to do. I found every way I could to get out of that world to play music, even if it was just nightclubs for $50 a night in the beginning. And it evolved. I'm still doing music for a living. It's challenging because I'm not 30 years old anymore. Funny thing, when I was growing up, all the schools and education systems worked against me because I wanted to wear my hair a certain way. They kicked me out of sports. They kicked me out of drama. They kicked me out of music. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, okay, well, it's time to go to college. So I was going to go to college and take a drama, you know, major and stuff like that. And they kicked me out of there because I got a real job doing acting and playing music. And they said, if you're going to leave the college to do a real work, which we're teaching you for, we're going to drop failure. So
really? That's not right.
it's the way it is. It's bizarre.
Greg, you actually had to go to class. That's what they wanted.
Class wasn't. They didn't teach what I was interested in college
there
back then. I think
true.
They teach rock and roll now.
Yeah, they do.
Now that it's kind of passe, per se.
I think they do, you're
then,
right.
They didn't teach. But they don't now, you know. I mean, they didn't then. So, you know, and then, of course, I got busted one day when my parents, their relatives came into town. Oh, let's go to school and see Greg in college in his drama class. And they go to the classroom, and the teacher's all, can I help you? Oh, we're here to see our son Greg. I brought the relatives in from the, you know, Midwest. And, oh, he hasn't been here for 2 months. You
know? Uh-oh.
So, I feel very fortunate that I've been able to, I'm still doing music for a living. My advice is, to anybody, to find the passion, find something that they're really interested in, whatever it is, and just do it. Find a way to make that work, because otherwise you're killing yourself doing something you hate or aren't interested in, you know. That's my advice to people. You know, life's challenging as it is.
But, be realistic about it. Like you said, it's not going to necessarily be rich and famous overnight. You have to work at it, and you know you can't expect.
Neil and I have been doing it since high school, and we're nowhere near rich and famous. So it may not even happen at all, you know, on
exactly.
that level.
That's what I'm saying. You can't expect that.
You do it because you like it, and if you like it, you like it. I mean, I have brother-in-laws who go out and play golf, and they spend a ton of money every weekend playing golf, and they're never going to make it onto the PGA tournaments. You know, I say that to them once in a while. Why are you wasting your time? You're never going to go pro. Because that's what they say to me. Why are you still playing guitar? You're never going to make it. You know, it's the same thing. It's because, well, I enjoy doing it. This is what I do. It's my thing.
It's your thing, exactly. And you have one of your videos is like that. It opens up with a cartoon about why are you playing, and the wife is yelling at the guy, and it's my only time to do it. And
that's part of our rock and roll rehab show, because we finally decided we need to help people not waste their lives the way we have. So even though we say follow your dream, we thought some people, you know, you shouldn't follow your dream. You should just give up. I mean, I'm saying this facetiously, but that's our basis of our rock and roll rehab show, which is up on the website. And the whole theme of rock and roll rehab is there's, you know, 12-step programs. I don't want to make fun of addiction because it's not funny. But in our case, we're kind of addicted to rock and roll, so we needed an organization to help us kick the rock and roll habit. So we started Rock and Roll Rehab. And that's the basic theme of that. And when we do the show, we have the projection and the animation, and Greg tells the story of how we've, you know, wasted our lives chasing the rock and roll dream.
Well, you're obviously still enjoying it, and that's very important, and you're making it work, and that's important. Where do people, so go to the website, obviously, to get info on the show. Do you play it only in California? Are you planning on touring it? What are the plans for the show?
Well, our drummer, I've known since grammar school. And I played in bands with him in junior high, and we've been together all this time. Unfortunately, he's a drummer. It's a very physical job, and he also worked construction for years and years and years, and his shoulders are giving out. So he physically can't do it anymore, and we are now without a drummer. We've gone from, like, 10 people in this band. Now we're down to 2. Yeah, so we would love to play. We love to tour. We love to do the show again. We were at the Hayworth Theater a year ago. And that was great, but now we need to get the band back together. But the band is, you know, kind of dying off.
Can you recruit some new folks? Because I guess these other people just packed it in. They won't want to hang in as long as you guys. Is that what you're saying? Besides the drummer, the other people just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, you get older, it's hard to find drummers because, you know, older guys, young guys don't want to play with the older guys, and the older guys can't physically do it.
So a lot of them can't get away from the house. They got you know, chores to do, and you know, their wives and family. You know.
Well, you have to get a drum machine like what the guy, the REM, when the guy left, right? The drummer left, and they didn't replace him. I don't.
Did they? But now did they use a drum machine?
I think they did for a while. Yeah, and then I don't know if they got somebody else to go on tour. I guess.
Great.
REM, I
thought about doing the drum machine thing, but to duplicate our drummer, who's Pat Meehan, probably one of the greatest original drummers I've ever played with. It's just hard to, there's no way I could even get close to his style. It'd sound like a drum machine. It'd be a different trip. I'd rather have a drummer. We're looking.
Yeah. Well, certainly when you're playing live, I think that's harder to do, too. Well,
yeah.
I wish you guys the best. You're still doing it. I think it's great to keep going after your passion and keep at it. Because you love it, and that's really important, and I think that keeps you young, too, and it helps folks. This is a great website. Check it out, Rock and Roll Rehab. It's Rock N, the letter N, RollRehab.com, and find out more about Greg Piper and Neil Warner and the Tuners. We're going to leave you, let you go with a song called Let Others Dream.
Thank you, Amy.
Great
song. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Neil. Come back and see us again, okay?
Thank you.
Sure, anytime.
Take care. It's the Tuners on the Amy Bedrock Weisha. Stick around.
touch that dial. We'll be right back after these brief words from our sponsors.
Chock full of nuts is that Heavenly Coffee. Heavenly Coffee. Heavenly Coffee. Chock full of nuts is that Heavenly Coffee. Better coffee a millionaire money can't buy.
Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. I'm enjoying that nut, mounds don't. I'm enjoying that real milk chocolate, coconut and munchy nuts too. Mounds got deep dark chocolate and chewy coconut. Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. Peter Paul, I'm enjoying that nut. Peter Paul, mounds don't.
Because
sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't.
Now you're just making up rules. Who made you Judge Judy and executioner?
Welcome back. It is the Amy Beth Arkley Show here on the VCR on a Monday. 347-857-4505. Get you in this conversation. We're going to thank the tuners again, Greg Piper and Neil Warner, for stopping by. Check out their website, rockandrollrehab.com. I'm going to switch gears and talk some of the hot justice stories. Boy, busy day on the justice front today. Already a federal judge has ruled the New York City stop and frisk policy unconstitutional. More on that. Attorney General Eric Holder, I think in another hour or so, will be speaking about ending or modifying mandatory minimum drug sentences. So that's on the horizon. And I just read this article. I don't know if you saw it yesterday in the New York Times op-ed piece. Nicholas Kristof has a piece, very troubling, about a guy who was, I guess, arrested at one point or actually served time for burglary years ago. Got his life in the straight and narrow, is married with three or four kids at this point, and was helping out a neighbor, a friend, a widow, clean out her husband's belongings when he passed away. It's in the garage or the attic, and they found some old shotgun shells. And he had them in his possession because he had a record as a burglar. When there were some burglaries in the area, he was a suspect. They went through his house, looked at things, found these shotgun shells. He was never arrested or charged with the burglaries, but because he was a convicted felon and the law says he can't have any kind of weapons or ammunition, he is now going to prison for 15 years. Believe it. Crazy. The judge said there was no leeway in terms of the sentencing. Well, I don't get it. First of all, judges, if there's no leeway, if you don't have judicial discretion of some sort, then we might as well just have a computer figure out who does what time, number one. And that's also be a whole issue with mandatory minimum. But also, there's such a thing as prosecutorial discretion. Why did they bring this case against this guy? It was an innocent thing. He had it in a box. He didn't even know he had them. He wasn't using them. He wasn't burglarizing anymore. And now he's in prison for 15 years. His wife has got to raise the four kids by herself. The government is going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep him in prison. I think it's in Tennessee, and they have a situation where you can't even get out. Or maybe it was a federal crime. I don't know. But he's going to have to do the full offense, the full bit. That's crazy to me. Just crazy. All right, 347-857-4505. Let's bring in our friend Patrick Moore, the criminal investigator and the founder of the All Things Crime blog. He has been busy this weekend working on a whole slew of cases. Patrick, thanks for joining us, as always.
Well, thanks for having me, Amy Beth.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I know you've been busy on the blog with all kinds of stuff this weekend. The first one, of course, is the DiMaggio case. Thank goodness, the best ending. We had Hannah Anderson rescued safely. But you have a very interesting and troubling article that I just saw on your site about James DiMaggio, the guy who apparently killed this Hannah Anderson's mother and her brother, burned down his house, and then abducted the young girl. She was found safely, thank God, over the weekend. FBI killed DiMaggio. But now you have an article on your site that talks about DiMaggio's father. Tell us a little bit more about that and where you found that.
Well, this is like kind of an amazing thing. I was very surprised to learn about this. But apparently DiMaggio's father, also James DiMaggio Sr., 18, 19 years ago, he was a guy who had a lot of problems. He was a methamphetamine addict. And apparently he actually, unbelievably, he kidnapped or attempted to kidnap, abducted a 16-year-old high school girl who he had developed a dangerous crush on, you know, pretty much identical to what his son, the dead man, James DiMaggio Jr., had done. And he actually attempted to abduct this woman. Her boyfriend was there. I guess he tied her to a bed, and then she managed to escape. And so she got away. So she's talked to the press in the last few days. So as if that wasn't strange enough, what's perhaps even stranger is the fact that DiMaggio Sr. later, shortly, I believe a few months after that, committed suicide on, of all days, August 10th. It would be August 10th, 1995, exactly 18 years before DiMaggio Jr. was shot in questionable circumstances in the wilderness in Idaho. So, like, the deja vu, or whatever you want to call it, it's just flabbergasting. I've never seen anything like it.
Wow, it is very eerie, very strange. Obviously a troubled man, a troubled story, a troubled family, but wow. The best ending we could get was this girl to get rescued, and she's going to be, and has been reunited with her father. One thing I have to say, and I know it's true, but I don't think these pop psychology hucksters do anybody any favors going on television and saying what a long road ahead this girl has. We know she's going to have some issues and problems. Let her deal with it. Let's now make it a private matter with her and her family and let them heal and let them deal with it. We don't really have to hear about how horrible it's going to be. You know, I don't know. I don't, that's my feeling. And I'm somebody who has some training in psychotherapy. I'm also somebody in the media, so I understand it's the temptation to talk about it. But at the same time, sometimes you have to let people be. If they want to come out and talk, that's their business. But I think they should just let them be. What do you feel about that?
Well, I have to admit, I put in one or two lines in this morning's post about that it would be a long time before anyone will know how she's able to deal with the trauma she's endured. But to my credit, I held it to two lines.
Too long. There you go. You're not diagnosing. You know, when they start diagnosing on the air and everything.
What's amazing to me, Amy Beth, is in my experience, one of the remarkable things about humankind, mankind, and womankind is that people vary greatly in the degree and their ability to overcome trauma and hard times. Some people are actually absolutely devastated by it. Some people recover very nicely, surprisingly well. A good example of that, I would say, is Michelle Knight in the Ariel Castro case, who is clearly the most victimized, or it appears she was the most victimized of the three women. She appears to be extremely strong. And, so my point is, people vary a great deal on to what degree they can overcome trauma.
Yeah, you don't know the resilience of the human spirit. And Elizabeth Smart seems to be doing quite well, although she'll admit that she has her issues, and she's come out about it, but she seems to have done quite well in addition. But, yeah, you know, I understand, of course, the curiosity that we all have about these people and these stories, but at some point you sort of have to let them be. And I just think because we have this 24/7 media matrix and we're all on the story all the time and we're all talking about these things, sometimes that might not give them a chance to heal. But I'm really happy she got home, and my heart goes out to her family and her father, and it's the best result that they could hope for given the horrible circumstances of last week. So that's one of your big stories. You've had a bunch of them. I mean, you're really working overtime on your blog, so congratulations on that, and thanks for keeping
it going. Well, there have been a lot of interesting cases. You know, there are a lot of other cases I would have liked to do posts on, which I haven't even had, you know, time to get to. There's the former male Dallas... I'm sorry. The former male Dallas Mavericks cheerleader apparently, shot, I guess, his wife and a couple of his kids. And I'm not sure exactly of the details, but he apparently murdered four and wounded five. And this just happened a few days ago. I mean, just like extraordinarily horrible. And I may have the details wrong. It may not even, but I believe it was his wife and kids. I meant to do a post on that and couldn't even, you know, get to it because these other stories came along, including the Derek Medina story, which were hot topics
Facebook.
That I felt, you know, I had to, talk about
Facebook,
them.
The Facebook killer, this is a fascinating story. I mean, this one is like, as I said, I think I said this to you, these people are giving novelists a run for their money. Come on, you know, let me have some imagination here, people, okay? As a fiction writer, this guy killed his wife, and then he posted about it on Facebook, and then he turned himself in. Give us a little more info on this and what's come out since.
You know, all that I really know is that, as I see the timeline, and I believe this is correct. First of all, a little bit about the argument. Apparently, and a little preamble, apparently they were married in 2010 or thereabouts. They divorced at a certain point. Then they remarried, and they've been remarried for 3 months when this happened. Now, according to his story, and this is in the police affidavit, when he did turn himself in, apparently they were having a fight. It was a two-story condo. They were fighting upstairs, in a townhouse, actually. They were fighting upstairs and downstairs, and apparently she, you know, according to him, she was punching him, and she, you know, pulled a knife at one point, and he disarmed her, and it went on, and they went around and around, and then, my God, then he shot her. And, you know, so he shoots her. We don't know exactly at what time. Then at 11 a.m. would be Florida time, Florida daylight time, I assume, he posts his Facebook post. And I was really struck by the way it seemed. What was most important to him, to say goodbye to his Facebook buddies or to state that he had killed his wife? Or it was just odd as can be. And then on the next, 30 seconds later, apparently, he sends the photograph that's been seen around the world of his wife with her legs kind of pulled back to the sides, just like lying there, and that picture of course went viral, and so I mean it's odd to me and probably to all
very
of
odd.
Us that the first thing you would do, you've killed your wife, first thing you do is post on Facebook about it, just very strange.
Well, the thing is, and the posting was so strange because it was something like, "See you, Facebook buddies, I love you, you're going to hear about me on the news," or something very kind of glib and weird. This is the social media backdrop in which we all live, I suppose, and I guess maybe he's, I don't know what they're going to use as his defense. I guess it's going to be temporary insanity, I'm guessing, or something, and then he flipped, and this was just his way of dealing with it or coping, but it is very strange. He did turn himself in. We'll give him credit for that, I guess. And, of course, if you're outing yourself on Facebook, I guess you have no choice.
Amy Beth, is, you know, if the guy hadn't had a gun, his wife would be alive,
yep,
and he wouldn't be facing life in prison. I mean, it's really as simple
as that. And I think you wrote that. You said that. I agree with you.
Exactly.
With
and my colleague, BJW Nash, looked it up for me. He discovered that 3 women are killed daily in domestic violence incidents in the United States. 3 a day, that's about 1,000 a year. And of those 1,000, how many do you think are killed by guns that were there in the home? I don't know, but I'll bet you it's 800 or
I'm sure it's
900.
Yeah, and
it's not
most,
easy to kill people without a gun. Whereas with a gun, it's exactly easy as anything.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I've never really held a real gun in my hand, so I don't know about that. But I'm sure it's scary
You're probably one of the few.
I guess so. I've held prop guns in my hand for like theatrical productions and so forth, but that's scary enough when they go off. But yeah, I think you're right. There's too much. I agree. I'm always saying that too. We live in a gun culture, unfortunately, that seems to be becoming more and more predominant. And this notion that here I go again, my soapbox. But we're clinging to the Second Amendment with such dear life that literally dear lives are lost every day. I mean, it's scary to me. And probably if he hadn't had that gun in that house, you're right. They might have scuffled with the knife if there was a knife or whatever. But, there are people that stab their wives or stab their husbands. That does happen, too, as we know. We just had the Jodi Arias case. But that is
right.
The harder,
but that's
right.
Much more. It's much more unusual. And, if he hadn't had a gun, she might have been injured or he might have been injured. I mean, who knows?
Right.
But, chances are she wouldn't be dead. And he wouldn't be facing life in prison. What I was struck on that case, because social media has become such a big part of our lives for many of us, and at this point it's a significant part of my life. And it made me think with Derek Medina, who apparently, and there's some evidence he was an unstable individual, because if it's the same Derek Medina, he had apparently published, and it's unclear whether it is or was, but he had published some like self-help kind of e-books about like psychic possession or demonic possession. He's with his wife in another city, and apparently she's being like a ghost or a spirit is plaguing her, and he tells her, "Go back to sleep, I'll take care of you." And then he writes, then the same ghostly creature comes in, has a fight with him. And so if it's the same guy, or even if it's not, it's pretty clear that he was probably an unstable individual. And I wonder, with the preponderance of, you know, time spent on social media, if some individuals have trouble distinguishing their social media world from what you might call real life. I think most of us are able to do it. If suddenly social media was not there and I'm as addicted to it as anyone else, I'd, you know, maybe have some withdrawals, but I'll bet you in a week, let's say no blog, no social media, none of that. Within a week, I would have adjusted within a week, and, you know, I'd be doing other things.
You'd probably get
more
sleep, right?
I would get more sleep. There'd be a silver lining there. But I'll bet you that, you know, highly unstable individuals really have trouble distinguishing. And what I connected to the analogy is, remember back in the day we used to always hear that because of all the violence on television and in the movies, that, you know, does it cause, or the video games, does it cause kids to become violent? Well, I suspect
well,
in most cases,
that.
I suspect right.
I mean, like the NRA still blames Hollywood for that. They say it's not the guns, it's all this violence in the media. They're all still blaming that.
Interesting. Right. And I would say that all the violence in, you know, in the media or in television, film, et cetera, I'll bet you most people, the vast majority of people, it doesn't cause them to be violent at all. But once again, I'll bet you that certain unstable individuals, it probably has a big effect on them.
Sure.
And I would say in Derek Medina, it seems like it's that kind of a case.
Well, I think you're right, because it has to do with your how centered you are, how healthy you are mentally to begin with, what is in your life, how empty your life may or may not be. Now, he obviously was married, so it's not like he was completely lonely. You always think of these people who are all alone in the world and not having any connections. He obviously did have, I don't know who else he had in his family, but he was married. But
He had his father. Before he went and turned himself into the police, he went and visited his father.
Oh, he went to his, and what, his father was the one who told him to turn himself in? Or?
Well, that's unclear, but he definitely went there. I thought what was very interesting, too, so then he goes to the police, he turns himself in, the police come to the condo, and they discover, and this is so like frightening, and you talk about eerie, his deceased wife's 10-year-old daughter is there alone in the condo with her mother's dead body.
I didn't even realize they had it. Now, this was her daughter from another marriage?
I think it has to be, okay. Yeah. But that's the interesting thing about the news. It's like, you know, certain things that really strike me are kind of just passed over or glossed over.
Yeah, and I didn't know that.
I think in one of my posts on that I mentioned, well, you know, maybe he would have, because, you know, and trying not to condemn him more than he's already like condemned himself, you know, perhaps he tried to get the daughter to come with him rather than leave her alone there, but perhaps she was so horrified by what had happened that, you know, she refused, like, you monster, stay away from me. I mean, who knows?
She witnessed it. Oh, that's awful. See, I don't think I saw that part. I didn't even realize there was a trailer.
Well, that's because it was just, you know how, and one of the things that I really try not to do, though I'm sure I'm guilty of it too, in writing posts, when I read a lot of online news articles, and what I notice is they're written in this kind of, to me, peculiar form in which, like, each sentence seems to be oftentimes a separate paragraph. And they seem like they don't really work necessarily chronologically, or, in other words, they're just kind of slammed together. And little things up.
You mean it's bad? Are you trying to say it's bad writing, Patrick?
Well, I don't want to say it's bad writing, but perhaps it's fair to say it's not, you know, it's not good writing. I mean, I'm working on the blog as fast as I can go, but, you know, I try and I make mistakes, but, you know, I try to at least make the writing, you know, acceptable writing. And it appears that, you know, on, you know, internet journalism, it's just a strange style that they've adopted. Because I see that in so many articles. It's like, you know, it's like the old thing about a paragraph. You have a topic sentence, and then then you back it up with some just like the basic stuff, right? The basic stuff, your English 1A, your composition teacher will teach you. or your
you would hope they would adhere to that, but you're all right, I guess, because, and this is why blogs and sites get a bad rap, and I always say, you know, I mean, I work for some sites, and I have my own blogs, and I'm a good writer, so a lot of people do have standards, like you do, but unfortunately, you get a bad rap because it seems to be this notion of just slap it up as quickly as you can, which therefore the writing isn't so great, and maybe the facts aren't so hot either. You know, you just get it up there as quickly as you can is a problem, but not all sites are the same, which is why you have to seek out
or at least a key detail or point is glossed over. And I mean,
yeah.
to me, that thing about the daughter being there, I mean, it was barely mentioned.
Yeah,
she was there.
Deal.
And so,
when you mentioned that, I thought, well, maybe I just didn't see it, because the other problem when you're reading a lot of stuff is sometimes you don't finish everything, and I might have missed it as a reader. But you're right; they may have just not mentioned it, so that's not good. It's an interesting story. It's fascinating. I know what else you had on your blog that was interesting was, and as schools getting ready to start college, people going back to college, this thing at Vanderbilt University, which is a very well thought of institution.
Oh,
they've got a big scandal brewing with a rape. Is that right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, that's just absolutely awful. It was on June 23rd, I believe, four Vanderbilt University football players. In the wee hours, they raped an unconscious woman in a dorm room. The only way it was discovered was because, this kind of struck me as if there's, you know, plenty of, you know, not so good stuff going on there in the dorm. It was Gillette Hall. The campus police were looking at, you know, they have, you know, their video surveillance, and they were looking at video surveillance. They were checking out some other incident as if there was a wild party or, you know, who knows what, maybe a fight. And they happened to see these guys doing something that looked suspicious. And that's how it was discovered. The poor woman who was unconscious, she apparently did not report it on her own. She, you know, maybe would never have reported it at all. But so in any event, the campus police got onto it. To their credit, they immediately contacted the next morning the Metro Nashville police, who, you know, launched a full investigation. The university threw the students off the football team and definitely threw them off the football team. So the students vanished to the four winds, the four perpetrators of the gang rape. And at this point, as it stood a day or two ago, one of the four perpetrators had been arrested, and the other three are wanted men who have apparently gone back to their you know, wherever they're from.
So they're fugitives. They're fugitives. That's interesting. Wow.
Well, at least they were a day or two ago. I can't imagine it's, you know, I mean, we'll see. But there certainly were.
It's interesting that the school, I have to give credit to the school, though, because a lot of times what happens when you have these horrible incidents on college campuses, the schools try to, squelch it because they don't want to get bad publicity. And that's why a lot of people are not aware of what goes on in some of these campuses. They try to really put a lid on it. So to their credit, they didn't, and they arrested these, or they tried to get these kids arrested. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. And clearly, if they have it on videotape, I don't know how they're going to get out of it. And how is the woman doing? Do we know anything about her? Is she okay? Was she unconscious?
One of the officials made a statement. It's been very hard on her, but you know she's being fully cooperative. And, you know, that is, which makes me think she'll be willing to testify against the four men, the four rapists or alleged rapists. And it does seem pretty definite that they are guilty. And so she's, you know, she's doing her best. And that kind of brings back what you said, like, you know, don't intrude too much into the, let her have a chance. I mean, I suppose in a weird way, it's probably good she was unconscious when it happened.
Horrible.
You wonder what she
was aware of even when she woke up. Did she have weird dreams? I mean, sort of like a Rosemary's Baby kind of thing, where you think it's a dream, but something really horrible is happening to you. All that kind of stuff. You wonder. That's interesting. The other fascinating case, of course, that we've been watching, and it's funny that HLN dropped it like a hot potato the minute they dropped the murder charges against Andrea Snyderman and just made it a perjury case. But it's still a fascinating case. Andrea Snyderman, the woman whose former boss and alleged lover, Hemi Newman, was convicted of killing her husband last year, is now on trial, or she was originally going to be on trial for murder. Now it's just perjury. It's still a fascinating case. If you can watch the live trial feed, I think Wild About Trial has it, other places have it. And I guess in Georgia they're covering it The local channels are having it, but HLN, I guess they only like murder at HLN. That's it. It's still a fascinating case. I know you had a blog up today about why she...
Well, it's kind of connected with what you said about the guy in Tennessee who they've given 15 years for having the shotgun shells, even though he was currently completely rehabilitated and he was, you know, living a good life, yet he's doing 15 years in prison. In California, he would be doing 5 years in prison, I believe, for that. For, like, felon in possession. But what I talked about, and it's probably just the mood I was in, but, you know, one thing that I've learned working for 10 years in the legal business is that prosecution is extremely selective. Prosecutors prosecute certain people. They don't prosecute other people. Now, it seems pretty clear, and I could be wrong, but, you know, I would think most people would agree that there's not much doubt that Andrea Snyderman, you know, probably perjured herself on the witness stand at Hemi Newman's trial. She's probably, you know, told some fibs or some whoppers along the way. It appears pretty obvious she had some kind of an affair with Hemi Newman. Was it consummated with sexual intercourse? Who knows? Does it need to be an affair? You know, probably not. You know, who knows? But, the position I took in this morning's post is kind of a no harm, no foul position. In other words, you know, whatever she did, whatever fibs she did or did not tell, Hemi Newman was convicted of the murder. You know, he's in prison and he'll be in prison for a long time, whether it's a mental institution or a prison. So the state has convicted him of the crime that he committed. The state is also convinced that she had nothing to do with the crime. So, therefore, her perjury while under oath...
Well, I don't know if they're convinced of that, but they're just saying they don't have enough proof because originally they did charge her with murder, or the conspiracy to commit murder.
Well, right. But, you know, the prosecution has a tendency to charge all kinds of people with all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Before, just that Rhode Island case where someone broke into the couple's house and killed the parents and kidnapped the baby or the young child. They already, you know, arrested the wrong person and apparently have released one person.
Right.
And they've arrested. Now, that all happens very fast. It's telescoped. But, in any event, you know, the issue, you know, we worship or, you know, many people worship the, quote, rule of law. However, since the rule of law is applied in an extremely selective fashion by prosecutors to set it up as kind of this sacred cow, to me, is a little bit absurd. In other words, it's the sort of thing people trot out with, oh, we have the rule of law here. But yet, the rule of law, it's only as good as the people who are, you know, operating within it.
No, I was just going to say, I would say that with Andrea Snyderman's case, if you followed the Hemi Newman case, and I did, when she testified, she came off very badly. She didn't do herself any favors. There's no question about it. It did seem like she might have been lying. She was also very antagonistic, etc. But if you look at her police videos, which they have played, and this is why I think she may take a walk, I don't think they would have charged her because she didn't come out, she didn't come off that way in the police videos. Now, was she lying a little bit about the affair or the alleged affair? I don't even sure if it went to the extent of an affair. I think it was a flirtation. There may have been something there. She obviously was uncomfortable admitting it because she felt guilty. I don't really know. I mean, who knows? She may be this femme fatale mastermind who planted the seed for Hemi Newman, who, by the way, killed Rusty Snyderman, the husband, because he had angels looking like Barry White and Olivia Newton-John telling him. So, I mean, the man obviously had some issues. So even if he did testify, and he's not going to testify against her, he has his own issues. So who knows? I know they had a friend of his testify, or they're going to allow her to testify, this real estate agent, Melanie White, who did testify in the Newman case, and she may testify in this case, too, or she did.
Well, she has testified.
She did testify already to say what he told her. But, again, it's all this hearsay of what he told her, his impression
right.
of the affair,
you're
alleged
right.
affair, which may or may not have happened.
It is hearsay.
All in his head.
The notion that you can be charged with, you know, felony perjury for, you know, lying or perhaps lying about a extramarital affair is kind of crazy. I mean, people do that, you know, in other words, if you become embroiled in the legal system, your rights, what you can and cannot do, you know, right or wrong, you know, completely change. And you can be, you know, you'd be charged with all kinds of felony charges for, you know, kind of everyday things.
Well, I was thinking that if she had been charged with a murder, that she would just sort of fall on her sword and say, well, yeah, I lied about the affair, but I didn't kill my husband. I mean, the other thing about it is she did seem in the police tapes, if you saw some of those, to be very upset about the fact that Rusty was dead. I mean, maybe it was an acting job. Who knows? I know one of the discrepancies is that supposedly she knew that he had been shot before the police told her. That's the whole thing. When did she know? Did Hemi call her? Was she in on it? All of that. But if she was, I mean, if she's so cold-hearted, she obviously loves her children. Would she want to have him killed in front of the kid's school? I mean, there are just a lot of things that sort of run through my mind that I'm thinking maybe she was in too deep with this guy. She wasn't thrilled with Rusty. It's true, he was kind of a non-starter. It's not what she really signed on for. I guess that's the basis of what their motivation is in their mind. He was a Harvard MBA who couldn't keep a job, basically, and she had to go out and get a job, and she had two little kids, and maybe she was
That's the reason it was so important to her to keep the job? Because the family really needed for her to have the job?
That's what
okay,
said,
I was wondering about that because see, I did not follow the Hemi Newman trial, so I'm really uninformed in many aspects of this.
But I think also part of it, the motivation for some people is to say that she wanted to get away with, get rid of Rusty because he obviously wasn't providing the way she wanted, and this way she could get the insurance. And apparently, some people say she's so nefarious that she doesn't even want to be. She used Hemi as a tool, but she really has some other guy she was interested in. I mean, have you seen her? I know she said that Sandra Bullock is too old to play her, but you know she's not exactly gorgeous. So I don't know that many men are tripping over themselves for her, but who knows?
Well, I kind of wondered about that too. That's kind of an odd thing about this. It's like, well, clearly she must have turned on the charm with poor Hemi.
With poor Hemi, exactly.
Having followed his trial? I mean, I just see the photographs of him. To me, this looks like a very, like, kind of an attractive man. And
Hemi?
It's easy to...
I think, well, Hemi's problem also was he was a middle-aged... midlife crisis. He was married. He was in deluxe debt. I think he was manic depressive. I mean, he was a bipolar. He had a lot of problems. He spent a lot of money because of part of the illness, I think. His wife didn't have a job, and I think he fantasized about Andrea being a great catch, the way maybe Andrea fantasized about him being a great catch. I don't know. But to me, it's a tragedy, and maybe she did use him consciously or unconsciously. I don't know. But, you know, it's sort of like saying, if you complain about your spouse, and, you know, does that mean that if somebody goes out and kills them for you? I mean, it's like Strangers on a Train. Remember that Alfred Hitchcock movie?
Sure.
Yeah,
oh, I've seen
crazy
it many
guy
times. Sure.
That wants to get wants the guy to kill his father, and then he goes out and kills the ex-wife. I mean, it doesn't. I just don't know if there's enough there that they can, and that's why they dropped the murder charge, because obviously there wasn't enough there to prove it. And I'm not sure that she really is guilty. I mean, as horrible as she came off in that trial, she came off like a shrew. If you see some of those, and I think they're playing clips of it in the trial now, in her trial, I don't know that she is guilty. And like you said, I don't know. Certainly, there's not enough for the murder charge, and I'm not sure that the perjury charge is worth the trouble. But
what I said, it seems to me. I mean, you know. Let's say she is convicted of at least some of the charges. You know, what's a fair outcome? I don't think if she is convicted, I don't think she should, you know, do a day in prison.
Yeah.
Because I
well,
don't
Well, that's probably
see,
why she didn't. Didn't they offer her some kind of deal? Is that
they
right?
offered her
sure.
apparently what, you know, they offered her apparently
year?
A year. And,
she wouldn't do
you
it.
Know, so she's taken a huge risk by going to trial because the judge is apparently a very tough sentencer. You know, I've suggested that, you know, I can't imagine the judge giving, if she is found guilty of several of the charges, I can't imagine the judge giving her more than 5 years. But that's a terrible stiff jolt. You know, whatever she's, you know, guilty of.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me that it's, you know, she should go to, you know, prison for a long time. Even she shouldn't go to prison for a year. I mean, I say she should, you know, she should do community service. You know, put, as we always say in this business, put some, you know, water back in the well. You know, make up for her wrongdoing, but you know, or you know, to the degree it was wrongdoing, by you know, doing something good for society. It's like it strikes me as like counterproductive to, like you know,
and she has
lock
and
her,
she has the two little kids obviously to take care of. Yeah,
she has the kids to take care of. Good point.
I have a feeling she may take a walk. That's just my feeling. We'll see what happens. The trial goes on. Patrick Moore, always a pleasure. You've got a wealth of info on your site, All Things Crime Blog. I recommend folks take a look at it. But you got to give yourself some time because you can waste a lot of time on that site. It's not a waste, but you just use up a lot of time because there's so many fascinating things going on. I appreciate it. I hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Amy. Beth. See you.
Thanks, Patrick. That's Patrick Moore from the All Things Crime Blog. We're wrapping things up here. I just want to remind you about Friday at 1 o'clock. Lane Stone will be here, fellow mystery author. She will talk about the Tierra Investigation Series. The latest is Domestic Affairs. And Trudy is getting ready to unveil, you know it, our favorite Jerry Lewis song, I Love a Murder Mystery, upon the radio. Also, we're going to celebrate Elvis Presley with a special tribute to the King of Rock and Roll. That's all coming up on Friday. In the meantime, don't forget to follow the show at the Blog Talk site. It's the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. You can find me on Twitter at AB Writes. And if you have a story to tell, or you want some creativity coaching questions answered, hop over to the website, amybetharkowitz.com. In the meantime, have yourself a great week. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. We'll talk next time. Thanks, Trudy. Thanks, Aurora. Thanks, ML from TCS. Have a great day.
You start a conversation, you can't